I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. Columnist Ellen Goodman talked with her mother about everything, except one thing, Goodman writes, how she wanted to live at the end of her life. Today we've teamed up with the Center for Practical Bioethics in their annual symposium in downtown Kansas City for a conversation about how to deal with pain and death in a graceful way. We'll ask the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer why she turned to talking about end-of-life issues on Up to Date, following this hour's news.
Support for NPR comes from Carbonite, automatic and encrypted cloud backup solutions that provide access to backed-up files from any device. Carbonite.com.
Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Toward the end of her mother's life, Ellen Goodman remembers being bewildered by all the choices. Another bone marrow biopsy, a spinal tap, pain treatment, antibiotics. Even after a career spent writing her widely syndicated newspaper column that dealt with so many of these issues, she remembers how unprepared she was to make so many decisions. She wrote, "I was still blindsided by the inevitable." Ellen Goodman is in town for appearances with the Center for Practical Bioethics. She is co-founder of the Conversation Project, which is a group dedicated to getting everyone's end-of-life wishes expressed and respected. We're coming to you live this morning from the Muehlbach Hotel in downtown Kansas City before a live audience attending the Center's Joan Berkeley Symposium. Ellen Goodman has spent most of her life chronicling social change and its impact on American life. She was one of the first women to write for the op-ed pages and became the most widely syndicated progressive columnist in the country. She started her career with Newsweek as a researcher, became a reporter for the Detroit Free Press, then moved to the Boston Globe, where she began writing her column in 1974. In 1980, she won the Pulitzer Prize for distinguished commentary. And Ellen Goodman, what a pleasure. So good to have you here in Kansas City.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, you know, it's called the longevity revolution. What am I going to do next after I retire? You've obviously gone through some of that yourself. How did you process all of that, and how did you wind up where you are right now?
Well, we are in the midst of a longevity revolution. That 100 years ago, people lived to be 47, and now they're living to be 78, 80 if they're women. And that whole trajectory of life is changing in front of us. So the idea that you are going to retire at 65, that concept of retirement came about, was created when people died at 63. So, you know. So now we have this whole period of good time, and a lot of us are thinking about, okay, what do you do next? You hit midlife, you hit later life. And a lot of people, in thinking about that, are thinking about what you would call second acts for the greater good. There's a whole phrase now called encore careers. And I guess you could say that I am in an encore career, that I left column writing 3 years ago and thinking about what I would do next.
So when you left the column, did you know what you were going to do next, or did you go through a process?
Pretty much a process. I was meeting, you know, how, when women go through stages of life, of course, they form a group, and they meet with other women. That's what we do.
And, even Pulitzer Prize winners go through.
Right.
Yeah.
And I had been meeting for several years before while I was thinking about my next steps with a small group of women. We met every 6 months, and I looked around at this group, and I realized that these were all women whose obits were already written. So, I mean, I knew the first line of my obit once I got to Pulitzer would be, you know, Ellen Goodman, Pulitzer Prize-winning column, died yesterday, although hopefully it won't read that tomorrow, you know. So what do you do next when you've checked off a lot of the boxes and you want to try something new in life? And a lot of people are thinking about that. On my part, I was thinking about going from covering social change to maybe making it in a different way. And that coincided really with the experience that I had taking care of my mother as she was declining.
And that was quite an experience for you, because in reading about it, it sounded like you were all out of sorts, even after years that you spent writing about many of the issues that you were dealing with at the moment with your own mom.
That's right. I mean, we're at the Center for Practical Bioethics, which has been at the forefront of so many of the cases that I had written about all these years, from, you know, the Nancy Cruzan case,
yes,
which is, of course, famous here, and the Terry Schiavo case, all of these cases around, all of these stories around end of life issues. I had written about all of that, and yet I hadn't face the reality of how many decisions you have to make, often for people who are not able to make decisions for themselves.
Decisions like what? What are you talking about?
Well, it depends on the situation, of course, but often they are about what kind of health care this person you love would want and wouldn't, how they wanted to live. I tell the story that my mother was the sort of person who would listen to your problems until you were sick of them, you know? So my mother and I had talked about everything except talking about what she wanted for end-of-life care. And this is pretty typical. And so we had not talked much further than her saying, if I'm ever like that, pull the plug. And, of course, there was no plug at the end of her life. So I had to make decisions for her at various times, some of the things that you mentioned about, would she want this kind of treatment? Would she not? Is this going to actually help her or not? And very often I had to stop the kind of trajectory of medical care. You know, you get on a kind of charrette when you're in the system, and there's always something they can do these days. We know that the wonders of medical technology have come with this side effect of often unwanted technology or too much.
And you found yourself so many times wishing you could hear your mother's voice in your own ears. What would she want me to do at a moment like this, if it was only that easy, right?
Yes, I think I did wish afterwards. I'm not alone in that, because so many people who have been through experiences of their loved one dying and who were left with uncertainty about whether they had fulfilled the wishes of that person. You know, those people who have not had the conversation with the people that they love are much more likely to, the survivors are much more likely to feel depressed, uncertain, about whether they had done the right thing, and to suffer longer because of it.
Ellen, was there a moment that you came to with your own mom? Was there a pivotal decision or two that you wrestled with perhaps more than any of the others?
There were moments that came upon you so suddenly that you don't have a lot of time to wrestle. I'd be sitting at the office a couple of times this happened, and I would get a call. My mother had pretty severe dementia at this point, and I'd get a call, and they'd say, your mother has pneumonia. Do you want to give her antibiotics? And I would be thinking, excuse me, you know, what is this question? And I'm a trained reporter, right? What is this question? And I realized, oh, they're asking, do I want her to live or die? And, you know, I would be thinking, could I call you back? You know, could I have another minute here? And
What would you do?
And several times I said, well, yes, give her antibiotics. And then a third time I said no, and she recovered anyway. and then I realized that I was still in that state of bewilderment, that death now comes with so many choices and decisions. I think we live with an old mindset that death is somehow natural. And in this world, it really isn't as natural as we continue to think. And that's why we need to have the conversation. And it was from that experience that I began to talk with others. And together we met with a small group of people who consisted of clergy and media and medical people. We sat around a table and asked each other, come on, can't we make this better? Can't the people we love die in the way that they would choose? And we all took off our professional hats and told stories. There wasn't a person in that room without, however, you know, impressive their CV was, right, who didn't have a story. And I think that everybody listening to this now has a story. It's one of the great still secrets that we all harbor stories about the loss, the good death or the hard death of someone we lose, we have loved and lost. And at the same time, we haven't really been sharing those stories. We've kept them close, and it's only when somebody talks about the subject that there's this torrent of stories,
yeah,
that comes out.
Well, you've used a couple of phrases here I want to pick up on. One of them is the use of the word conversation, and you've started a group called the Conversation Project. I want to talk about that. And if those of you in the audience have a story you want to share about the loss of a loved one that might fit in well here, by all means, come on up. We have some microphones around the room here from the Muehlbach Hotel. We're visiting with the Center for Practical Bioethics. Don't be shy. Come on up and visit with us. You can also drop us an email at updatedate@kcur.org. So, Ellen Goodman, you began this group called the Conversation Project. Tell us about what that is.
Well, the Conversation Project is a public engagement campaign to have everyone's end-of-life wishes expressed and respected. Two parts.
That simple, yeah.
It's that simple and that complex. We believe that change has to come from the outside in.
Yeah.
We want people to talk to the people they love at the kitchen table early because a crisis is a terrible time to,
yeah,
learn. So we want them to have these conversations before there is a crisis. And that's basically been at the heart of what we've put together that's on our website. We have a conversation starter kit that makes it quite easy.
And it's right
to
online.
It's online.
And I've been through it. It's very simple to use. It's very straightforward.
It's a low bar of entry. It's not very medical. We ask people the questions not what is the matter with you, but what matters to you. So we're very oriented towards people talking about what their values are and what their feelings are about the way they want to live toward the end of life.
You know, you have to clear two bars here, it seems to me. One of them is been around for a while, even before your group got going, which is this idea of getting folks comfortable with the idea of talking about stuff like this. A lot of folks don't want to. And the other bar, it seems to me, and you just hit on it, Ellen, is this idea of, you know, people think about talking about end-of-life issues, and that automatically means complicated legal forms like living wills. And people are you know, wary of what that is and what it all means. And I'm wondering how you encourage people to get past both of those things.
Well, I think there is a kind of denial of – there's a silence that goes on. And often it goes on between older parents and adult children, that the older parents don't want to worry their children.
Absolutely.
You know, and
my dad being one of them.
And
yeah,
the adult children don't want to even tiptoe up to the idea that their parents might die, you know. So everybody knows the reality, but we feel reticent to talk about with this each other. And because of that reticence, we often feel both generations end up feeling alone and lonely in these decisions. So there are many ways that we can talk about to break through that silence. And we've been exploring a lot of them. A lot of them are through storytelling.
Yeah, I just had a phone call from my father just a week ago. And in the course of the conversation, he lets it slip that, oh, yeah, he's been in physical therapy. Oh, that was news to me. What are you in physical therapy for, Dad? Oh, I slipped on the ice a few weeks ago up in good old Minnesota. And, yeah, I really dented up the old hip. But I think I'm going to be okay. I'm just limping a little bit. He didn't want to worry his son, you know.
He didn't want to worry his son, but he also wanted to tell his son.
Well, of course. It came out sooner or later. In this case, later, right?
That's right. And I think that one of the ways that to open up that conversation with your father is, well, first of all, please do send him with my best wishes, the conversation starter
kit. He's a fan, Alan, by the way. Yeah.
Well, there you go. I'll autograph the starter kit for him. And then ask him to talk about what he went through. He no doubt lost his parents.
That's a good idea.
Was that an experience of a good death or a hard death? What has it made him think about? I have a 93 and 94-year-old aunt and uncle, and the minute I started talking to them, they each had ideas. They each told me stories. And my aunt told me the story about her sister-in-law's death, which was a template for what she did not want. And my uncle, who'd been in the Air Force in World War II, told me how being 94 was very similar to being 26 and flying over Germany with planes going down on either side, because the way he thought about it now was one day at a time. And he had also said, you know what, I'm not going into hospitals anymore. I am where I am, and this is it. And, I'm 94, and I don't want any more hospital treatment. So those conversations, once you open them up, are rich. They're not hopeless. They're not depressing. They are rich and intimate. And we've done them with younger people, too. We work with a group of younger people at the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, which has been our partner and housed us. And we did a project with young people in their 20s and 30s, and we helped them think about it, and then we said, okay, now all of you go home and do this with your parents or your loved ones or your spouse, and then come back in 2 weeks and tell us about it. And they were all pretty nervous, I want to say. But they went home. And they started in a variety of ways, and some of them were kind of a male-female breakdown. One young man and his father were in a car facing forward when they had the conversation, which is a much more male model. Somebody else had passed along a story that had been written in The New Yorker. Everybody had a different way of entering it with our starter kit. And they came back and they universally said that those were the richest conversations they had had in their family with the people that they loved. So they weren't dark and depressing. They were very rich and rewarding.
So starting with stories, starting with how your parents' own parents faced down end-of-life issues might be something to think about.
That's definitely. And, of course, it isn't always older people who die.
Yeah. Ellen Goodman is our guest. We're coming to you live from the Muehlbach downtown Kansas City. We're talking about end-of-life issues. Joining us now is Dr. Richard Payne. He's the John B. Francis Chair in Bioethics at the Center for Practical Bioethics. He's also director of the Duke University Institute on Care at the End of Life. And, Dr. Payne, it's a pleasure to see you again. Welcome to the show.
Great to be back. Thanks. Yeah. May I ask Ellen a question?
Please help. Yes, yeah. By all means.
As a physician, I've talked with some patients who don't want to have these conversations for two reasons. Some are just have cultural beliefs that if you talk about things like this, it'll tend to make them happen quicker to you. And then there are also people who basically are kind of turned off to this because they say the tenor and tone of these conversations are always about limiting what people will do to you, whereas they sometimes have concerns that, well, we need more care delivered. So can you speak to how the conversation project would address those kinds of concerns?
Yeah, I'll speak to the second one first.
Hang on a minute right there, too. Go ahead,
Alan. Sure, I'll speak to the second one first. It's absolutely true that Americans confront the current health care, with two conflicting fears. The fear that they won't get enough care, and the fear that they will get unwanted care.
Right.
And I would say the African-American community, in particular for completely right historical reasons, has been concerned about not getting enough care. But that and poorer communities have, for all of those reasons. At the same time, our belief is that if you put the focus back on the patient and family, on the person, and you say, tell us what you want, that expression, that focus on the person, that respect for what the person's wishes can rule and be transformative.
Yes.
Because if you don't have to be afraid if you are at the center of this, if your wishes are being expressed and respected. Mm-hmm. And those are two pieces, and sometimes the expression isn't respected, and sometimes, but, you know, that's completely true. The question about multi-ethnic conversations is absolutely right on. At the same time, I think many in the younger generation are much more open mm-hmm. to having these conversations, so that those ethnic differences are somewhat muted as they go on. But you have to be extremely respectful to various traditions and direct the conversation differently.
You know, Dr. Payne, I wanted to borrow your expertise just for a moment. When you've been on the show in the past, you've talked about this central idea that the focus when it comes to medical care so often is on the individual and whatever the individual needs. But you've also had a point that these days there need to be other factors perhaps tossed into that stew.
Right.
And you have a very deep concern about that. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, I think we have, you know, focused on the primacy of the importance of autonomy of the individual being able to make these decisions for themselves, because, you know, in the reaction to the bad old days of medical paternalism, you know, it was really a great and important response. But I also think that particularly for many people who come who have cultural perspectives that are not traditionally Western, this idea that you can articulate a autonomy that doesn't encompass their role in the family and community is seen as quite limiting. And so I think that we in the medical community need to broaden our sensitivity to how the community and the broadly defined family are also have their own autonomy and stake in this.
And to what extent should the central question of should unlimited care always be an option on the table, as opposed to thinking about that in some other ways that perhaps that denies other folks care that they might need at some point?
No, I think unlimited care shouldn't always be on the table. I think the right care should
exactly.
always be the focus. And what is the care that the person needs? But we have to be sensitive that some people come to these conversations with the idea that there's an agenda on the other side to limit care. So I just think being very open about, you know, what our agendas are, being very transparent about and actually being authentic and focusing on, you know, this is about what you and your family need and how we're going to respect your role and position in your family and community is really key.
I also think it's key that we have the focus on cultural change and not simply on the doctor-patient
right.
relationship. Because for several reasons, we believe that you change the system from the outside in. The comparison that I always use is what happened with birth in America, that it didn't change because the medical system initiated all of these changes of getting women out of the stirrups and inviting their husbands in with a video camera. They, you know, it was not doctors, trust me on this, in operating room, who changed birth in America. It was because the culture changed and the way people wanted changed, and they brought that from the outside in. And by the way, I don't think it should be all on the shoulders of doctors in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you have these conversations in your families, that's an appropriate place to begin. So on our website, we have the conversation starter kit, but we also have a second kit there called How to Talk to Your Doctor, which we call Doc Talk. And the subtitle of that, which does not exist but is in my own brain, is How to Talk to Your Doctor when he or she isn't going to talk to you.
Right.
So
right.
We think that people can bring these conversations in there. And then we are hoping for another, you know, we're hoping also when we work with the medical profession, the first thing we do is we ask doctors, residents, and medical students to start by having the conversation themselves. Because we know at this moment in time that very few doctors are actually having them with patients. They're uncomfortable, they're untrained. And so the first thing that they have to do is have the conversation themselves with their own families.
And listen to this stat that's on your website, by the way, Ellen. 80% of people say that if seriously ill, they would want to talk to their doctor about end-of-life care, but only 7% report having had an end-of-life conversation with their doctor. Those conversations aren't happening.
They're not happening. That 7% of people have had those conversations with their doctors in California, which is essentially nobody, 17% in Massachusetts, and the figures are not that different in other states.
And that's because, Dr. Payne, what, doctors are simply, the obvious answer, overwhelmed, too much care to deliver.
Yes, and there are training issues, and there are issues about how we value what therapies we should give, how people are paid to do what they do. It's very complicated, but I think more and more physicians are getting the message, but we've got a long way to go.
There's a wonderful I was just going to say that there's this wonderful videotape. I don't know if I mentioned to you of Marcus Welby, you know, the famous, amazing doctor that we all wanted in 1969. And there's this videotape where he's telling the family of a patient that their daughter has cancer. And the mother appropriately gets weeping and crying, and he's trying to force information on her. And she's still crying, and finally he says, "You know, she's not listening. I can't give her the information. Give her some medication." And he walks out of the room. So I think doctors, as Richard would attest, are doing better than that now.
Right. Right. But it's a long road, though.
Yeah, it's a long road, and we're emphasizing communication skills in medical school and residency training, and all that's helpful. If I might just ask at least one more question. The Center for Practical Bioethics here in Kansas City, of course, has been engaged in trying to promote these conversations for a long time. We are now in 2013, and your wonderful project is engaged now. Have you thought about how your project can build on the work of the center?
I think we do build on the work of the center, and in fact, Myra Christo, who was one of the first people urging cultural change.
Right.
We are more of a media campaign, more of a public engagement campaign, but you were building on the work that a huge number of people have done, and we hope, at least in our belief, that we are raising all boats by delivering more attention, and we hope more public voices to this conversation.
Dr. Payne, thanks so much. Let's get one more of our participants in this symposium to come up to our microphone here. Give us your name and ask Ellen Goodman your question. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, I'm Judy Wechter. I'm the community educator for a hospice here in Kansas City. Hello.
Hi.
We spend a lot of our time working with the community and with healthcare providers and obviously with families regarding making end-of-life decisions, talk early, talk often, think these things through. One of the issues that we sometimes encounter, and of course we're in hospice, so we're frequently dealing with this closer to the end of life, is individuals in the family or the patient themselves that have a plan, but they have a significant other that is a usually a loud, vocal, local person that is inhibiting the delivery of the care that the patient wants. And we find that physicians are reluctant to challenge that, and we find that families are reluctant to challenge that one family member. In using these conversation techniques and these resources, are you seeing any changes with that?
The question that you raise about family dissension, mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean,
I own one of those. Yeah, six months on hospice, and my father finally passed away in a in-house hospice facility and was only there about 48 hours. And literally at 5 in the morning when we brought my mother in to say goodbye, and he died within 4 hours, she said, "This was so sudden." And we were all exhausted, but we were staring at her going, "What part, you know, the flavor of coffee out in the hall? I mean, what part of this did you not see coming?"
Well, I would say that emotionally, death is always expected, but sudden. Mm-hmm. I think that's just, but the question that you raise about families that come to the table or the bedside in this case with wildly different ideas. I mean, you know, it's not, shouldn't be any surprise to those of us who live in families, you know, it's like, mom always loved me best, you know. That happens a lot. One doctor said that he had come to think of something called the Seagull syndrome. And the Seagull syndrome is the child who lives furthest away flies in at the last minute and dumps all over the program. Only he used a less polite phrase. I think one of the reasons to motivate you to have the conversation is so that your kids won't get into that. So one of my close friends' daughters said to me upon hearing about the conversation, said, "Oh, my God, we better do that. I can just see us all standing around mom's comatose body having a knockdown, drag-out fight." So she was being a little too snarky about it. But I think that this moment, by the way, that's not about whether Johnny got a bike and Susie got the hand. It's not about your opinions. It's about your loved one's opinion. And that capacity of a doctor to turn the conversation back so that it focuses on the person and not on this dissension is an important part of the training. But it's absolutely important.
I think we've encouraged our physicians for a long time to use medical events as opening that conversation with the patient and haven't seen the results that we had hoped. And now we use that same analogy with the patient. After you have a medical event, sit down with your doctor and say, "Woo, that was a close call. We need to talk because if this happens again, I want you clear. I want you to know how I want things to play out." And we're hoping that by having that conversation with the actual patient, we'll get a little farther than we did with the physicians.
Thank you. And thanks. I've never heard that phrase before, the Seagull syndrome. What a great line. It's time for a break. When we come back, we'll continue our very good conversation here with Ellen Goodman about end-of-life issues. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. I'm hearing snow. I'm suffering from allergies. I'm wondering if this isn't my end-of-life issue playing out right in front of me here. Well, if you missed yesterday's conversation with our book doctors, you can find their spring reading picks and all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. On tomorrow's program, a panel of economic experts join us to discuss the country's financial woes and tell us how bloggers can help us better understand the situation. That and Brian McTavish joins us with our weekend to-do list. Well, this hour we're visiting with Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist Ellen Goodman. We're talking about end-of-life issues and her new project, The Conversation Project, it's called. Our way to reach us here, you can email us at updatedate@kcur.org or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Ellen, how many people have the project helped so far?
We don't know how many they've helped.
Yeah, hard to tell.
We know that since we've been, since our website has been up, which is theconversationproject.org, 100,000 people have come onto the website, which is great. It's a nice number. And 40% of them have downloaded the starter kit.
Huh.
So that kind of says to us people really are eager for a tool that's going to help. And then that other figure that I love, that people spend an extraordinary amount of time on our website, which is an average of 3 to 4 minutes. So that's I don't want to depress you about the state of reading,
but that is where
we are on that.
Yeah.
So we feel very lucky. We've gotten a lot of coverage and a lot of attention, and we just think it's the whole country is at a tipping point at the moment on this.
You know, Ellen, you say on your website, again, some more numbers here, that 60% of people say that making sure their family is not burdened by tough decisions is extremely important to them. I'm surprised that number isn't higher. I'm also surprised that this number isn't higher, that 56% have not communicated their end-of-life issues to anyone else. Those aren't really top-heavy numbers, are they?
Well, I think that they are pretty dramatic. I mean, I think the disconnect between what people want and how they are behaving is really extraordinary. I mean, one of the figures that's most impressive to me just in terms of the disconnect is that 70% of Americans say that they want to die at home, and 70% are dying in hospitals and institutions.
That was my next set of numbers, yeah.
And that, to me, is really extraordinary, because dying at home isn't necessarily a place, a physical place. It's a way. You want to die pain-free, comfortable, surrounded by people that you love, and living your life to the fullest until the end. And that is really a dramatic disconnect that we have to respect, because it says clearly people are not dying in the way that they would choose, and that is something we owe.
We have some other folks who want to join our conversation here at the downtown Muehlbach. Ma'am, tell us your name and fire away.
Hi, I'm Lisa Veglin with Hospice Foundation of America. Hi, Steve. Hi. You had asked earlier about stories, personal stories,
yes.
And it's interesting. The first ones that came to my mind were the negative ones, the ones I keep in my sort of mental file of how I don't want anyone I love or myself to ever die. But I've been around hospice and end-of-life care for a long time, so the next set I went to in my head were the whatever we call good death, elegant death, the deaths that I think many of us hope for, that I've seen both personally and professionally. And I guess my question, Ellen, is where is there a place for both of those types of stories on the table, for in terms of being agents of change, if stories are agents of change? How do we get both those negative and those positive stories out there, and what power do both of them have to make change in this area?
That's a great question, Lisa.
Well, I believe that stories are at the heart of this, that people don't respond as much to the statistics, even though you and I just went through our little litany of statistics. They respond to stories, and stories of good deaths and of hard deaths. It may be that bad news, you know, is news in the classic sense, and people are more motivated to change when they've had a really bad experience. But both of those stories. So we have been, at the Conversation Project, we have been collecting lots of stories, good, bad, good deaths, hard deaths, and sharing those. And we believe, again, that if people share those stories, you have a whole rich a database, for want of a better phrase, it's got to be a better one than that, that gives you an idea of how people are dying, how they are surviving. And those are most of the stories, after all, are in a sense about survivors. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we want to leave the people we love okay. Mm-hmm. That's a huge part of your legacy. You don't want to leave the people you love uncertain, depressed, fearful. So that is one of the real motivations to tell your own story, tell your own wishes.
Ellen Goodman, once a storyteller, always a storyteller. Spoken like a true journalist, Ellen Goodman. Lisa, thank you very much. Sarah writes us this: my 93-year-old father-in-law passed away in a small town 2 months ago, pneumonia again, following a fall and broken ribs. I had asked about hospice in the future a month before he truly worsened. I wish we had brought hospice in sooner, because they were wonderful in the 3 days we were involved. Their literature was helpful, but would have been more informative as we were going through the last months.
Boy, if there's one thing that I hear from everybody, it's that phrase about hospice: I wish I had gone there sooner.
Really? Yeah.
Absolutely. And I would say that was true in my own family. My sister died last fall.
And people don't go sooner because?
Lots of reasons,
sure.
Including that sense that
this is it.
No, and also that sense, too, of this is it. But someone was talking before, I think it was Richard, about you don't believe that you've come to the end. And hospice doesn't have to be the end, but there is something about it. People don't accept where they are. And, by the way, they don't get a good prognosis. One of the things that doctors could do a lot better job of is kind of telling you the story as it is, you know. So a lot of times the doctor-patient relationship gets focused on the next thing the doctor can do, and there's always a next thing in this world. until that moment when there is an honest discussion of saying, we could do X, we could do Y, none of these are going to help you. What is it that you want to do? Do you want to go home and spend some time with your family? Do you want to make sure that you're here for your daughter's wedding? What is it that you really want? Do you want to be comfortable? Do you want to have music surround you? Can we bring in a hospice person who can help you through this? Can you go to a hospice if that's available to you? And it's almost always too late. I know in my own family's case, we didn't really exhale until my sister was in hospice. And again, she was only in there 10 days, and even with everything that I know. So I just think it's just generally, if there's one little piece of information, just find out what the truth is to the degree that you can and make these decisions earlier to bring solace and help not only to the person who's dying but to your whole family.
We're coming to you live from the Muehlbach Hotel in downtown Kansas City. We're speaking to a group for the Center for Practical Bioethics, the Joan Berkeley Symposium. Sir, you have a question for Ellen Goodman, our guest. We miss her on the op-ed pages of our country's newspapers. She's right here with us. Sir, go ahead.
My name's Clay Anderson. I'm a hospice and palliative care physician, a cancer doctor, and a big fan. And I have a favor to ask of you, and I guess I have to direct it at Dr. Payne Richard, who is a mentor of mine from way back when. Conversations are about language and about words, and I have, as an academic physician over a number of years, spent a long time trying to teach to medical students, interns, residents, fellows, that treatment and care are not the same. And I noticed last night, and I noticed again today, that we seem to be equating those terms in our sort of dialogue that's as simple as we can make it. But I want to just ask you a favor to think about changing your words just a little bit, particularly in, you know, the conversation project, because my feeling as a physician in end-of-life care is that care should never be limited. And when you talk about not enough care, too much care, I don't think there's any such thing as too much care, unless certain people don't want their feet rubbed or don't want to be turned or don't want their lips to be moistened, which is almost never the case. And so I, you know, the even nurses and students, residents would say, withdraw care in the ICU. We should never withdraw care.
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful point.
Pound into them over and over again.
Yeah.
We're taking
no,
you off of either unwanted, unhelpful, or burdensome treatment, but we're not taking away the care, whether you're at home in a hospice unit or in a nursing home.
I think that's a wonderful point, and I'm going to change my language from now on. And I think one of the things that does happen in health care is that doctors are comfortable as long as they can do something, and the patient often gets a subliminal message that you can either have the next treatment or be abandoned. So that notion of transforming everything to say, hey, we're about caring for you, whatever your choices are, is probably really at the heart, and it's a very critical expression. And I will put that into my language, whatever you flash drive.
Well, Ellen, I hate, as a journalist, I hate corrections as much as you do. And here's one other one. It's the Joanne Berkeley Symposium, not the Joan Berkeley Symposium, as I've been saying here this morning. So I'm correcting myself there. Sue Ellen Fried, welcome to the show. So good to have you here.
Thank you, Steve. Joanne Berkeley was my dearest friend, and I want to tell a story about her end of life. Shortly before she died, my husband and I were having dinner with Bert and Joanne at their home, and Joanne posed a question to us, and she said, everybody keeps telling me how strong I am. And she said, I am not feeling strong at all. I wonder why people are using that word. She said, I'm feeling frail. So I said to Joanne, well, what is the word? How do you feel? She said, I feel free. And we gasped, and I said, tell us about free. She said, I feel free to cling to my grandson and sob deeply in each other's arms. I feel free to have the most unimagined, intimate conversations with my husband. I feel free to wake up every morning and not have any idea how it's going to evolve. I feel free to be in the presence of my friends' tears and not have to comfort them. And then she pleaded with anyone and everyone she was in contact with, don't wait until you're at the end of life to have those unimagined, intimate conversations. So in tribute to our friend Joanne, thank you.
Well, I think we can end this show right now. I mean, how do you go on from that? What a terrific
except to say I think that's just a beautiful story. Everyone here is touched by it. And I hope that you will share that with us. Just write it and share it.
Yeah, what a great story. Absolutely.
That is a story that people do need to hear.
Boy, terrific. Yeah, good morning.
Good morning. I'm Sherry Tedford with the Johnson County Department of Health and Environment.
Hi, Sherry.
In Johnson County, Kansas. But I'm here today as a daughter of someone that just lost their mother on March 8th, and she had a good death, and I can say that. It has been a 10-year journey, transition for her. She had what Joanne called the chronic diseases and the slow demise. And I guess my question is, the last 2 years of her life were spent in a nursing home, not my choice, but what worked best for us. She had a stroke 2 years ago, and after being in long-term care for 1 year, she was readmitted to the hospital after having seizures. And when she got back to, while we were in the hospital at that time, Midland Care Hospice in Topeka, came and talked to us about palliative care and about the TPOP. And I went back to the long-term care facility, and they had no idea what I was talking about. So my question is, why don't long-term care facilities have required conversation booklets or caring conversation booklets as required documents to be completed on admission to every long-term care facility? Because then, in a way, they're forced to discuss those things that they don't want to discuss. Even if they're there just for rehab, those conversations still need to take place. And it would eliminate all the crap that happens later.
Yeah.
First, Sherry, I want to say I'm sorry for your loss.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. But, you know,
no matter how long it is, it's still a loss.
But, you know, we sat vigil for 7 days with my mom, and it was the most blessed time in our family. We laughed. We cried. We yelled at each other. We got mad at each other. But I spent 7 days with my brother and sister, the more time than I have spent with my adult brothers and sisters than I had since we were children. And that time taught us so many things about each other, how to communicate with each other properly, and how to understand each other. And it was a gift to our family.
Mm. Well, that's wonderful.
Yeah, absolutely.
As to the question that you raised about whether people entering nursing care should be filling out some sort of conversation kit of some or going through the caring conversation, I think you got your work cut out for you. This is probably sounds like it's going to be your cause for the next many years. And of course, it does happen at many places, and it doesn't happen at many places. So this would be something that would be particularly for you as a health policy person as well as a child.
Well, you know, I assumed when she was admitted, and I'm a nurse by training. I was her DPOA for health. I thought she had a DNR on her chart,
after she had been in the nursing home for a year, I find out that she has no DNR on her chart.
Mm-hmm. Do not resuscitate. Yeah.
Why does she not have a DNR on her chart? You know, I could go on and on about all medical issues, situations.
Yeah.
But, you know, my frustration is that there's people that don't know. They don't know to ask the question. They, because they aren't familiar with it. I've been involved with hospice for 20 years.
Yeah.
And people don't know to ask the question, so they don't know that they need to do it.
That sounds like
a new
frontier
for
the conversation
project. Engagement.
Yeah.
That's why we all need a public engagement campaign as a part of this great cultural change.
I want to read one more email what we have here that came to us at uptodate@kcur.org. I have specifically talked to my parents, and we have agreed together that comfort care may be the best option. With modern technology, you can live for a very long time. However, if you can't do anything that you love or even eat, is that life? With the worrying of children about their parents, we all need to accept that death is a part of life. Everyone dies. We need to talk about how they can do so with grace and dignity. And that's sort of how we should wind up here today, I think.
Well, you know, every family's going to have a different attitude towards that.
Mm-hmm.
And the point isn't that the attitude of the questioner is the right one. It's hers. And that's why we need to each have these conversations as a family or with the people that may be making decisions for us and respect and express and respect our individual wishes.
Well, I want to thank Ellen Goodman for being with us today. Folks, let's give Ellen Goodman a big round of applause, if you would. Ellen Goodman is a Pulitzer Prize winner. She founded the Conversation Project. What a thrill to have you. Thanks for your time, Ellen.
Thank you so much.
You can find more information about our broadcast at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow on the program, a panel of economics bloggers discuss the country's financial future, and Brian McTavish is back with our weekend to-do list. Our thanks to the staff of the Center for Practical Bioethics for inviting us to participate here today. We had help from KCUR's Suzanne Hogan, Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, Chris Pruitt, and the staff of the Marriott Hotel and the PSAV. Our show's senior producer is Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.